Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Genocide Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host today, Jeff Bachman, a senior lecturer at the American University School of National Service. Thank you all for listening. Today, I'll be talking to Jarvis Tyner about the third edition of We Charge Genocide, published in 2017, and about its continuing relevance today. Jarvis, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jeff. Glad to be here.
Yes, it's an honor to have the opportunity to speak with you about the historic We Charge Genocide and the Black Lives Matter movement and the continuing relevance of We Charge Genocide today. Before we do get into a conversation about the book, can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Oh, sure. Well, I live in New York. I'm a leader of the Communist Party USA. And as you may or may not know, your listeners, it was really William L. Patterson, a leading member of the party and of the Civil Rights Congress back in the day, who launched the U.S. Ratification movement of the Genocide Charter and wrote this great We Charge Genocide indictment and became a national movement and so on. It was a very, very important effort, particularly in light of the McCarthy period and particularly in light of what happened in the Second World War.
Great. Thank you. I'm sorry.
Let me just add I am currently the chairman of the Communist Party in New York State, sort of semi-retired, but I operate daily as part of that collective leadership, and it's a very uplifting time we're in, and very difficult, challenging, but it's a very rewarding effort to fight this Trump problem and so on.
Thank you. And you mentioned William Patterson. To provide some background for our discussion, can you talk a little bit about William Patterson, the Civil Rights Congress? You mentioned other members of the Civil Rights Congress who also contribute to the charge of genocide against the United States. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The Genocide Charter Convention was passed by the UN in 1948. This is after the tragic consequences of the Second World War. And particularly as the Supreme Court Justice Robert H. Jackson said, he said that we generally don't intervene in other people's countries and when they do bad things. But he said the exception is what Germans did to Germans. And he was a prosecutor at Nuremberg. So he was making this point and supporting the idea that the charter. The 1948 it passed. And William L. Patterson was the head of the Civil Rights Congress. He was also head of the International Workers' Defense in the early 30s. And he was a principal political leader of the movement to free Sacco and Vanzetti, two Italian anarchists who had been arrested for some activity they'd done, but they were about to be hung. And so the whole movement united around them. There's some question whether they even did it or not. But anyway, so Patterson, African-American, his father was from the Virgin Islands. His father was from St. Vincent, but his mother was from Virginia. And he grew up in San Francisco. And he went to Hastings Law School. I think that's associated with the University of California system. And eventually found his way to New York and eventually found his way into, you know, that whole period of Renaissance in the 1920s in Harlem. He was a big part of that. He worked with Paul Robeson. They were very good friends. He worked with Alpheus Hutton. And he worked with Du Bois. And he was a brilliant lawyer and had an extraordinary ability to public speak. So he became a very active, and he eventually joined the Communist Party. And these were all what they call fellow travelers. Some were more than travelers. They were really with the, or completely with the party. And Pat led this thing. He was an international workers defense, and then he became, when it came, he evolved into the Civil Rights Congress, he was head of it. They had a group that defended the Scottsboro and so on. So after the McCarthy period, they led the fight to apply the genocide conventions to the situations of African Americans and other people of color inside the United States.
Thank you. Do you know where the idea came from to engage with international institutions such as the General Assembly?
Well, I think it was largely influenced, by the horrible experience of the Second World War, you know, the Holocaust. Jews were slaughtered. Communists were arrested and slaughtered. Socialists, homosexuals, people of color. And the Nazis had a master race concept, which is not dead in this planet. I'll tell you, it's still there, very much in the White House, if you ask me. And they did such terrible, terrible things. And the party at that time was under attack. The Smith Act, which outlawed the Communist Party, had been passed. This is after the Great Coalition, which included the Soviet Union, the U.S., and all the Western powers and the world against the Nazis and Japanese, you know, to call the Rome, Tokyo, Berlin axis. And that great feeling of the world was that we have to move to a much more positive set. So the party was yet under attack and being challenged, and their leaders were facing jails and so on. And the feeling, for my reading the literature, and of course Pat always, he was very, great orator. He always talked about this. We had to do something to shift the paradigm, to shift the discussion where it belonged, and that is the continued existence of genocidal policies towards people of color in the United States. And so I think they had, and the Rosenbergs were executed. It's a case of a frame-up. It appeared in every way to be that. And they were parents of two children, and they put them in an electric chair and murdered them because they said they had stolen the secret of the atomic bomb, because the Soviets couldn't develop it by themselves, right? So that was the whole thing. But when that happened, it was quite a declaration of war against the party and the left and socialism and civil rights groups and labor and all the things that were associated with moving to a more just society. So the consequences of all that, I think they had, let's move on this thing. This is the black question. Henry Winston, who was the chairman of the Communist Party for many years, he was a black man from Mississippi, and he came through the unemployed movement in the 30s and ended up head of the Young Communists and then head of the party national, along with Gus Hall. He used to say that the Achilles heel of U.S. imperialism is racism, is the struggle against racism. That's what they cannot defend. And if you remember, they persecuted a lot of people like Paul Robeson for raising that. So all of those things piled on. It was a brilliant move, if you ask me, to raise this question, but it was the right thing to do.
Great. Thank you, Jarvis. You know, we've seen, I think, a return to engagement with international human rights systems by Americans, including Americans of color, on issues from police brutality to the right to water with Flint, Michigan. In William Patterson's foreword to the second edition, you know, he did write of his disappointment that the General Assembly did not respond to his petition or to the petition. Do you see the potential for effective redress through international institutions, or do you think African Americans and other marginalized groups need to do it within the United States?
Oh, no, no. I think it was correct to do that, because even though the General Assembly didn't adopt it, I don't know if that had to do with the Security Council or not, where you know, everybody could veto any, excuse me. But it was nevertheless in a political sense, a great struggle to educate and mobilize people to fight racism, fight anti-Semitism, fight anti-labor and other things that held back people. But in this question of genocide, helped to dramatize it. And I think we would be, deficient in our efforts if we didn't recognize the international situation, particularly since most of the world was against Jim Crow and other things. And if we could get an honest reflection of the majority view through political work and activity and talking about it and spreading the word, if we could get an honest reflection of that majority, this could be stopped. And that's what the fight was. And as you know, eventually, of all people, Ronald Reagan, the U.S. for 40 years refused to sign this thing. But Ronald Reagan eventually signed it. We could talk about that later, but that was very interesting.
For sure.
That was the charter. He signed it.
Of course, with decades of petitioning by Proxmire, I think I'm for some reason I'm blanking on the member of Congress who gave, I think, thousands of
speeches. You got it.
Yeah. So that
he made 3,000 speeches every year on this issue, and he applied it to Vietnam, which terrified them that he would do that. But he was great.
Yes, as with the Russell Tribunal, maybe we can come back to that as well. In the prologue to the third edition, you write that, quote, they showed that racist terror, beatings, lynching, and discrimination were systemic. It was an institutionalized system of oppression aimed at doing great harm to African-American people. It was enforced by the conscious actions or inactions of government, by commission or omission to deny democratic rights, economic justice, and racial equality to the African-American people. Can you talk for a bit about the charges that were levied in Recharge Genocide and the extensive documentation of evidence?
Well, there's a mountain of evidence because they marshaled a very capable group of researchers. They studied newspapers. They talked to people in the South. They traveled. They got people to testify on the lynchings, on the beatings, on the murders, on the terror against Black women, women, and children. Over the years, from I think it was from 1883 to 1968, almost 5,000 Black people or 5,000 people were lynched in this country, and that's lynching itself. And 27% of them were white, but the great bulk were Black. And I don't know what the Latino figure, but I know they did that. They lynched Latinos, particularly in the Southwest. So this is terrible that all these people died over mostly trumped-up charges and over, the corruption of racism. One of the things that Robert H. Jackson, the Supreme Court guy, said that when a country mistreats its people because of their ethnicity or whatever, I'm paraphrasing, he said that the obvious and logical conclusion of that is genocide. And you can see it in our country today. We can talk about that later, but the president gets up and make an ignorant speech, and then these people come out with guns and police beat people and shoot them out. It's with unarmed and it's just terrible. Men, women, children. Okay. So the logic of this kind of mistreatment and racism, extreme misogynism, anti-Semitism, all of that, is the logic of it, is genocide. So he said, what they do in peacetime, this is Jackson, He says the oppression they carry out in peacetime, in wartime, it becomes genocide. So I think that was a good reading of history.
Thank you. And I should note that for the audience members who do get a chance to look at the book, just to echo what Jarvis said, the evidence is extensive, extremely well documented, and certainly makes a strong case. Related to that, maybe before I get to my next question, do you think when We Charge Genocide was presented, was it more a political text than a legal text? I mean, do you have any understanding what the expectations were for what We Charge Genocide might bring?
It was both political and legal. I think Patterson was a brilliant lawyer. The first time I met him, he came to Philadelphia. I was a young member of the party in 61. He gave a speech, not on genocide, but on general fight against racism, which included that idea. This was in 1962, maybe 61, 62. And he just laid it out in very legal terms, but it was extremely political what he was talking about. And I think that's reflected in the indictment. And it starts off with shocked by the Nazis' barbaric murder of millions of Jews and millions of Poles, Russians, Czechs, and other nationalities on the sole basis of race under Hitler. That's the kind of thing. And just as Negroes are murdered on the basis of race in the United States under Mississippi, Virginia, Georgia law, the General Assembly of the United States has adopted the Genocide Committee. That's what it starts off of, and that was written in 1948 as an indictment. It has the, so we say, the primature of Bill Patterson all over it. And I think it politically was a tremendous thing. Now, you look at the names of people who signed on it. I actually know some of them, although I came in the party a long time after this. I actually know some. There's a lady there named Mary Cow. She lived in Norfolk, Virginia. I know her quite well. She eventually moved to New York, her and her husband. And Mary was a very active lady, a beautiful woman. She's Jewish and from New York, but lived in Virginia. They had a business. They had 58. They just worked. And she signed this thing. Now, for a woman, a white woman, a Jewish white woman in Norfolk, Virginia, to sign on this thing with their state address, like so many others in Mississippi, black people signed, preachers signed it, and so on. People in the labor movement signed it, and as well as some prominent members of the party signed it, and of course Robeson signed it, and Du Bois signed it, and so on. This was a tremendous expression of united front anti-racism and the mobilization of that majority against the really the backward fascist kind of thinking in our country. So it was politically driven, but it had a legal framework.
Thank you. Thinking about something I think about somewhat often is the sort of mythology of the United States and the lack of accountability historically for ill treatment and genocide of indigenous peoples, of African Americans. We can look at, the current crises. And, I was going to say, We Charge Genocide has not been the only genocide accusation against the United States. Mm-hmm. The Russell Tribunal found the United States guilty of genocide in Vietnam, as you mentioned previously. There is increasing attention to genocide against indigenous peoples in North America. I wrote a book about the U.S. and its foreign policy and genocide in Indonesia, in Bangladesh, Guatemala, Iraq, and now in Yemen. How do you think the U.S. is able to maintain what I would describe as its mythological existence? And related question to that is, can things ever change systemically if some people in this country, in particular those also, or including those elected to public office, refuse to acknowledge and accept the United States' history of violence?
Well, one, if you're elected, you can also be defeated, which I hope will happen in November. But at the same time, I'm optimistic. You know, James Baldwin once said that African-Americans cannot afford to be pessimistic. We can't win if we're pessimistic. He said we have to respect and understand that we can win this battle. Martin Luther King understood it, you know, the arc of humanity bends towards and all that. And this is hope. And if you really understand history, the march of history, even though it takes time and often too much time, it is nevertheless a process of change. I mean, national health care was considered a blasphemy against the capitalist system. But now most people want national health care for everybody. They know it works. People are learning. They're growing. And that's what the process of struggle is all about. And some of us who, linger in the vineyards of politics get discouraged. But, you know, one day you're discouraged. 3 days later, somebody does something or somebody pushes a bill or somebody stands up and it just uplifts. So to me, I think we have actually made a great deal of progress, but not anywhere near. We haven't, reached the pinnacle of our strength and our possibilities, but we are moving in that kind of direction. And Trump actually accelerated it. We didn't have Black Lives Matter, but they were there, but they weren't as strong. And now the Black Lives Matter slogan is embraced by people of all races and colors, all ages, all across the country. 30 million people have marched under the against police brutality and so on, and murder, modern lynching. And that is because somebody stood out there with a sign and with a courage to march against, even though they knew the police, and they still know the police will hurt them, maybe even worse, kill them. And we now have a president who's turned these militias, along with the, unidentified police forces onto these demonstrations, but they keep coming out. Listen to Baldwin. We can't be pessimistic. And certainly we communists can't be pessimistic, or we'd be in deep trouble. So to me, I think that the fight is not only legitimate and right and correct and beautiful and all of that, but it has shown that the American people can be mobilized in their majority. It's significant that Trump stays in the upper 30s, and that's about it. But some places he has more, but in the overall sense. But when this is over, Trump will be lucky to be in the upper 10s. I tell you, because this country is moving and it wants change.
Great. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate your optimism. I describe myself to my students as a cynical optimist. You know, I'm cynical, unfortunately, at a relatively young age of 44, but yet I maintain my optimism, which is what allows me to do what I do in terms of teaching and writing. Could you tell us maybe just a little bit more about sort of the Black Lives Matter in historical context in the movement for rights of African Americans?
Yeah, well, it was initially formed as a Black movement. And I think that's the leaders of it at some point considered that the resistance to racism is a Black problem, and or at least should be Black-led, and that whites, if they straggle in and help us, okay. But then the first demonstrations, like Trayvon Martin, people like that, and what happened with the young man in Missouri, and all the other murders, you suddenly saw a lot of white people coming out. And it began to be a slogan, a concept, the breast feather, especially after the right says, oh, it's not Black lives. I want blue lives, or it's not Black lives. Yeah, we only care about Black people. Right, that's what you talk about. That is not what they were talking about. They were talking about racial oppression against people and its impact on democracy as a whole. And I would say that the leadership of the Black Lives Matter, a chunk of it, I don't know enough about the whole thing, but I know some scholars, friends of mine who work with them, have grown in their conceptual understanding of where racism comes from. And they are talking about racial capitalism now. They didn't talk about that before. Racial capitalism, what they talk about now. And they are welcoming people, white people, all kinds of people, and into these struggles. They are bonding a level of unity that we didn't have before. This is powerful stuff that if it comes to the polls, it'll be great. But in the ongoing struggle in history, this will be seen as a watershed, as a new level of struggle in our country. So I feel like we need to give great praise to that movement. Let me tell you a story now. Stop. There was a big march from Harlem, and the Young Communist League came out with a substantial number of people, not all of them, you know, but maybe 10%, 5%, I don't know. And they were marching from the state office building on 125th Street in Harlem down to City Hall, a long march. And when they formed, a group of well-heeled looking black folks joined in, and it turns out they were corporate types. And when they saw the Communist Party banner, they went up to the organizer. They said, "We are very glad to march with you, but why do you have these communists marching with them?" And the young woman in charge, couldn't be no more than maybe 25 or 30, she said, "We don't like capitalism, too. We don't like capitalism, too." And you know what they did? They rolled up their banner and they left. But the great bulk of people marched on. This is the new moment. The chairman and the co-chair of the party, Joe Sims, African-American guy out of Youngstown, Ohio, he said that this is a socialist moment. And a lot of people identifying with the socialist idea and transformation of society because capitalism has shown itself being capable of delivering equality and justice for all. Anyway.
Thank you. And don't hesitate to share stories, for real. You know, I guess you've already talked about optimism, you know, with the pandemic, you know, the police brutality, and any other number of issues on climate change and immigration. Can you tell our audience maybe a little bit more where you find your reason for hope, maybe something you know, that inspires you, or how people can become inspired to keep pushing on?
Well, yeah, for me, born in 1941, I'll be 80 next year. Born in 1941 in Philadelphia, West Philadelphia ghetto called Mill Creek. My mother owned a beauty shop. When I was a little kid, I was a kind of tall. Now I'm 6'3 and all that, but I was tall for growing up. So my mother sent me to a program at a daycare center, and then I had gained a lot of, so to say, verbal skills sitting in the beauty shop, talking to the ladies and listening to them. And they thought I was older. So my mother put me into public schools when I was only 3 and a half, maybe. And I couldn't do the work. It was too kind. When I got to the first grade, I was about 4 and I couldn't do the work. So the teacher called my mother in and she said, "What's wrong?" My mother used to be a teacher, school teacher in the Deep South in a single one room schoolhouse. And she said, "What's with your son?" And back in those days, if you didn't do the work, they would take you in a cloakroom and whack you. This is serious stuff. So my mother said, "Why?" He said, "I can understand why he can't get it. He seems like he's very smart, but he can't get it. I couldn't draw those little figures. I couldn't do all that." So my mother, so she said, "How old is the boy?" She said, "He's 4. "4? Get this boy out of here." So my mother, I sat in that beauty shop for a year. And my mother taught me. She gave me, got all the books from school, and she taught me. I went back. It was a breeze. But then I was sitting there, and I remember when they attacked Paul Robeson. And I heard them say, I don't know, I just remember all these things. They had a big impact on me. And the women in the shop, they were all working class women, domestic workers, garment workers, you know, maids and stuff like that, cooks. And they didn't make much money in the neighborhood, was generally poor, but they worked hard. And so my mother and I were talking about Paul Robeson, and one of the ladies said that a person like Paul Robeson who speaks out and fights, they're always going to call them communists, like that. So they weren't identifying what communism meant. They were saying it's used to defeat people that are fighting for good stuff. And all the ladies gave an amen to that about Paul Rosen. Same thing with the Rosenbergs. See, we had already lost our best teachers in school. My brother, McCoy, who was grew up to be a great jazz musician, Coy Chiner. He played with Coltrane and all that. But he just passed, actually, early this year. But McCoy had a teacher named Mr. Ivins. And he used to come on every day talking about Mr. Ivins. My mother said, he said, Mr. Ivins said, this was us. My mother said, who is this Mr. Ivins? Said, so I'm going to go up to school and see who he is. And he was a young Jewish teacher who was a member of the party. Because when the committees came down to purge communists from the public school system, he was one of the first ones to be purged. Now, they all got their money back and they all got whatever went on with their life. But they said, again, here's a teacher who is very good for my son. And then they fired him for his political views. Again, they said that. And so what I'm trying to say is the common people understood there was wrongs were being done and that this anti-communist thing was, used to scare people like racism was used to scare people. And they really felt that had to reject this stuff. We were going nowhere without it. And, you know, every racist that spoke up in the Congress was an anti-Semite, an anti-communist. You know, that's what we were dealing with. So now you know what to fight against. We see it. So I learned a lot just sitting there and listening to these garment workers, domestic workers talk about and the stories they told about working in rich people's houses. I cannot share with you, but I heard them too. And my, this little kid sitting there who's 5 years old, my mouth was wide open. And these ladies were telling these stories, you know, but it was educational. So my brother also, he became very politicized, particularly as a Muslim. He was a Muslim. And he educated me a lot. So about what was going on with black people. So it had a strong nationalist edge to it. But later, he became very, very much for unity and all that. Not just later, in a good short time. And he taught me so much. And then what happened in Birmingham, in Little Rock, big impact on us. And all my friends, you know, we were doing all the teenage things that you do, partying and enjoying yourself, and hopefully not get too much work out of school that we had to do school. So my friend Robert said to me one day, we were talking about Little Rock, he said, why do they hate us so much? And that idea stuck in my head. That was a good question. Why? So I spent my life trying to figure out why and trying to correct it, in a sense. And once I learned the link of racism to slavery, to the development of the capitalist system, what Marx talked about, primitive accumulation of capital, the richest people in the world were the slaveholders back in the day. They were the richest. I mean, it's trillions of dollars was made on the unpaid labor of African slaves who were treated like animals, commoditized human beings who couldn't have families, who couldn't learn to read and write, who didn't have the right to vote or anything. This was pseudo-fascism in our Deep South, especially. So, and my parents came from there. So anyway, it was a very, very good education process between my brother and my mom. Ladies, and what we lived in the neighborhood, what would happen in the neighborhood, police and all that. So anyway, that's how I grew. And then I got into the civil rights movement, first chance I got. And that's when I met the Communist Party. They were some of the more active people in the civil rights movement. So we did things like the barbershops at the University of Pennsylvania would not cut Africans' hair. They said they didn't know, but African complained they wanted a haircut, you know, and so forth. And we got them to change that rule that in the area of University of Pennsylvania, they had to cut everybody's hair. Then the American Bandstand was right near my house in West Philadelphia, about 6-8 blocks away. And it was not integrated originally. And a bunch of us got set up a West Philadelphia Action Committee, and we sent three black couples onto the show. And to get into the show, they had to stand in line outside. And the producer said, okay, you can go. We don't want you here anymore. You go away. They would say to different people who maybe they didn't want to be on the show. So when the first black couple, we put them separate in the line so they wouldn't get. The first black couple that got up there, the producer says, wait a minute, stay here. And so they're waiting for some security guy to come out and throw them off the line. Out comes Dick Clark, and he says, welcome. And that's because they wanted it to happen. And he was the kind of, he brought a lot of black artists on his show that other people wouldn't. And even though all the dancers were white, a lot of the top, you know, R&B singers and all that were black. And he brought them on the show. And he didn't want to lead this effort, but he clearly wanted to be, not be against it before, you know, and he did. And if you notice, when he moved the show to L.A., everybody, you see, first it was black people dancing and white people dancing with each other. You know, blacks with blacks, whites with whites, Latinos with Latinos. But when he got to L.A., everybody was dancing with everybody. And that was an interesting point. That was an interesting point in history to let you know, hey, look, they can have fun. They, nobody's fighting each other. Nobody's whatever. They're having a good time. Great dancing. Oh, this is, you know, anyway. So don't get me started, but these are the kind of these are the kind of things that that made me feel very powerfully in that optimism about change and things like that because I was active. Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for the. I did not know that about American Bandstand, and it seems, you know, there's these little things that may seem like little gestures that are visible expressions of anti-racism, right? So yeah. Well, thank you, and. You know, I'm sorry to hear about your brother, but I have already taken a quick look and I see that he's worked with the John Coltrane Quartet, and I'll definitely be looking into that some more as a jazz fan. So, well, you know,
five Grammys, cool. 77 albums, and a fan base of really millions around the world. He was one of the top 10 jazz pianists in the world. He was. You'll see. Buy one of his records.
All right, I will. No doubt. Yeah. Well, thank you for all of your time today. I really appreciate you taking the time. And I'll be in touch.
Okay, thank you very much, Jeff, for having me. And everybody should pick up a copy of We Charge Genocide if they can. It's a very, very enlightening and uplifting, even though tragic, consequences. Keep your struggle.
Definitely they should. It's something that is not talked about through a genocide perspective enough. So, thank you again. Have a good day.
You too, Jeff. Take care.
Thanks, sir. You too.